This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Think about it. Deep conversations with Uli Bear on big ideas and great books.
Really thrilled today to welcome Professor Charlie Louth. So first of all, Charlie, thank you so much for making time to speak with me today on the Think About It podcast.
Not at all. I'm very pleased to, yeah.
I just want to introduce you for a second to our listeners, and we're going to be talking about Rilke today, a poet in whose work I have great interest, and you have just published a really fascinating book on Rilke. You're associate professor of German and fellow of Queen's College at Oxford University in England. I'm speaking to you right now. You're in England, I presume. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, Queen's indeed, yeah.
So you're a specialist on 18th, 19th, 20th century poetry, mostly German poetry. You've translated Hölderlin's letters. You've translated Rilke's famous letters to a young poet and his letters to a young worker. You've also written a book on Hölderlin in translation, edited books on other German language poets, including Nelly Sachs. And you've more recently published this book with Oxford University Press, Rilke, The Life of the Work. So just thank you so much for taking a time out of what looks like a very busy life to me.
I'm sure it's no busier than yours, Uli, but yeah.
And I was excited to be able to speak to you. And as you know, I have a great interest myself in Rilke. And then the podcast is really about literature and books in general. And I'm really happy to have readers that range from everywhere from high school students to people who are returning to books they read as high school students, maybe 80 years ago. And I literally had listeners who said, I read something like this 72 years ago. Rilke is one of these poets who has this perennial interest and fascination outside of the German language world and in translation. And I would be curious to start out maybe by asking you, where did your interest start that results in these beautiful translations and now in this really incredible book, which I really admire? And I want to ask you a couple of questions about this book, which was just published by Oxford University Press. So where did you start getting interested in Rilke?
Well, it goes back quite a long way. I mean, I've always been, when I say always, you know, since I was a teenager, I've always been very interested in poetry in English mostly. And then, you know, very soon, if you're interested in poetry, you come across Rilke as a name, you know, very quickly. I think I very first heard Rilke actually in France, but in an English translation, and it was the Leishman Penguin International Poets. Yeah, I think a lot of people first came across Rilke in those translations, but nowadays one doesn't necessarily think they're the best that you can. They're a very odd translation in some ways. So, I mean, I just came across them there, and then I knew a few people. I met some people about that time, actually also in France, who were very keen readers of Rilke, including a friend who wrote a novel which has the Eighth Elegy sort of printed as a kind of sort of epilogue to the whole thing. It was really just that way. I don't know. I mean, I studied French and German at university, and then I did Rilke then. I chose to do Rilke then. And I suppose I've been reading him ever since. I mean, the book has taken a long time to write. I mean, you know, more than 20 years, really.
That's actually interesting. You say it took a long. It doesn't read that way.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's very informed. And maybe for our listeners, we both have a kind of interest in Rilke which exceeds an academic interest. We're not just interested as an academic writer. Rilke is not usually the writer we pound out and say, oh, another poet, I have to learn what this poet means in the tradition or how that poet works. Most people are touched by Rilke in a way that goes beyond the academic interest. And I feel that what I really like about your book, and you can maybe tell us a little bit about how you conceived this book, which is not just chronological, but really focuses on what you call the life of the work. Mm-hmm. What I like about the book that it seems to continually start afresh. And every chapter says, I'm going to look at these poems now. I'm going to look at this poem. And I'm going to look at this now. There doesn't seem to be a kind of ambition to be exhaustive. And it doesn't also ever read exhausted. It feels to me very lively. And it felt more like you read it, you wrote it pretty quickly. That's what it sounded like, which in a good way, in the best possible way.
Well, I think it would be true to say I wrote it quickly in the sense I didn't revise very much. I don't write very quickly, but on the hand, I don't go back over what I write very much. But I think I was quite deliberately, I mean, it's partly just to do with an approach to poems in general. So I think that one should try and approach poems freshly, even if one knows them well. Each time one reads them, that has to be, in some sense, as if for the first time, really, especially with a poet like Rilke, who's very much working towards opening up possibilities and making you kind of see the world in a slightly different way. And if you come to them with already a preconception of what you're going to find there, then that is to go against the kind of poems they are, I think. But then also it's an academic book, I think, but it's also, I was very conscious writing it that, with lots of exceptions, but nevertheless, there are exceptions. If you read writing about Rilke poem, you only get somehow, you just get a little aspect of what's going on. And of course, I can't write about everything that's going on in a poem either. But I'm sort of trying to kind of talk about the experience of reading a poem and what it can sort of make happen, what possibilities it can kind of throw up and sort of make real, if you like. I mean, Rilke himself, I mean, I start off with this in the book, actually, but Rilke himself did write a few poems about reading poems, about reading, anyway. And they're all very interesting because they talk about not so much the actual reading itself, although that is part of what his focus is on, but they talk about the moment when you look up from the book. And so there's this sort of transition from the immersion in the poem and then the sort of coming back to the world around you. And it's in that transitional moment where you're sort of partly still in the text, but on the way out of it, that's where the potential that lies in reading lies, I think, for Rilke. And so I try to stay true to that, more or less, in the reading of the whole work, pretty much. I mean, obviously not every poem, but the whole span of Rilke's work. Because I think that if you don't do that, you're not really staying true to what Rilke wanted these poems to do, or what the poems do, in fact.
Can we stay with this for a moment, this moment of looking up from a poem? And I'm curious what, because you sort of have that experience in many poems, what the reader actually goes through at that moment. So you're reading a poem, and some Rilke that you talk about is poems about hydrangeas or flamingos or a carousel or a unicorn or something, all these themes which are somewhat pre-modern to us, kind of weirdly out of some mythic time, and yet you read them and there's a phrase sometimes where you describe this nicely. It's also a kind of bodily response. You look up for a moment, and it's as if in those moments you find yourself in a slightly different space than when you started reading a poem.
Yeah, I think it is spatial, so... I mean, when you read a poem, especially a poem like one of Rilke's, which especially from the Neue Gedichte, actually from the new poems, which have this kind of really quite intricate syntax, and they demand real focus from the reader, they're actually quite difficult poems, although they're not often thought of as difficult poems in Rilke's sort of criticism, but they are actually, they're full of sort of obstacles and complications. So it demands a huge amount of kind of concentration and, bodily involvement, I think. I mean, as you read them, you can almost feel the syntax unfolding simultaneously on the page and sort of in you as you kind of retrace the unfolding of the poem. So you have this kind of huge involvement, which I think probably is one of the reasons why Rilke has got this sort of great following, actually, that the poems demand more of you, in a sense of more aspects of yourself than lots of poems do. And so, you're kind of drawn in. You almost have to become part of the poem in order to read it. I think it's a sort of like a bit like breathing, really. So there's a sort of concentration involved, and then you look up, and there's a sort of that concentration opens out, and with it, certain possibilities seem to open out. But you can't really say what they are exactly. I don't think they don't have a content. Perhaps it's more just a form. I mean, another way of thinking about it is that I think there's a kind of transition, a movement that you have to participate in. And then it's almost as if you build up a kind of momentum. When you get to the end of the poem, then you kind of carry on outwards beyond it, back sort of back into life in a way. Or it's not back into, because you haven't been out of it, but it's sort of into it with a new kind of sort of impulse. But again, it's hard to talk about because it doesn't really have a particular content.
Let me ask you something, what you just said, which is, I think, really at the heart of what we're trying to just to say, that you're not taken out of life. You don't go back into life. And I think that's a very important thing for people. Initially, people think Rilke, German, difficult poet. Yeah. But actually, there's, first of all, a certain kind of pulling you in that looks a little bit simpler than other poetry, although it's very complex. Once you start translating, you realize how complex those poems are, because you can't capture a lot of it. And the early Rilke is so, there's so many internal rhymes, external rhymes. It just keeps on sort of reinforcing its own patterns. Yeah. It grows on you. But what you just said is, you're not immersed in the poem, absorbed by the poem, and then you look up and say, oh, I'm sitting in this room, and I'm sitting in the park, or I'm sitting on the train. You actually in life and then deeper in life.
Yes, right. Exactly.
And this is really important, I think, because Rilke is, and then we can later talk about the elegies and the angels and the sonnets, which gives people a sense, oh, this is about some metaphysical realm beyond us. This is about transcendence. Mm. It's never about that, it seems. No. It's about that we don't have an option to leave this life, but we have an option to go more deeply into it, which is strange. Yeah.
No, I totally agree with you there. I mean, I think that is exactly what Rilke might well have said himself, really, and that is what the effect that the poems have, or certainly can have. I mean, another way of thinking about, maybe another way of putting the same thing, is that, you know, what Rilke undoubtedly also does as a writer is he's quite supremely kind of sensitive and also expressive. So he has a keener sense than a lot of people, at least, as to sort of how it feels to be in a particular time and place. And then he has an amazing language with which to sort of turn that into words. And of course, in turning it into words, he then deepens it precisely, that feeling, because it's suddenly given more structure, more definition, and you understand it better in some way, I think. But then, of course, that process always becomes a version, I think, of understanding that all experience is sort of transient. So, you know, when you try and pin down what it is that you're experiencing in a particular moment, you can deepen that, but then in the end, you come to a point where it's sort of fleeing from you again and escaping you. But what's incredible about Rilke, I think, is that doesn't become, usually anyway, it doesn't become a sort of nostalgic or sense of loss. It's more a sense of reality, I think. So these things passing from us, that's what life is made up of. That doesn't mean to say that life is escaping us, that we're not somehow losing something. But we understand something about the nature of loss, I suppose, but which is actually just another side of life, I suppose.
What you just said, I think, is to me a central, probably to me as a reader, my personal reading, the central question, what you just said, that we are kind of led into the secret of the transience of life, which Rilke says in many letters, we constantly distract ourselves. It's too unbearable, of course, to think that things will not last. Yeah. Then he gives us these, and then I'm sketching the kind of arc of your book, which is not really an arc, but it's, you work chronologically. And as you know, I'm really interested in the kind of middle where he's to this transition that other people have talked about. So let's say he takes us into a situation, as you said, into a place, into the experience of being in a cathedral or in particular in the afternoon having a cup of tea. It's never usually a grand moment. Sometimes they're very small moments. He takes us into this moment with incredible care and specificity. And then he lets us realize this will not last. Although I gave you such an intense or immediate experience of it. And as you said, that realization is, well, this will not last, does not lead to a sense of regret or grief in a sense of nothing lasts, we will die.
Yes.
So he keeps you in that moment, and then he deepens that moment by saying, it's even deeper to us precisely because here we can see how transience is part of us. For people who know and love Rilke, really, that makes some sense. For philosophically or existentially, this makes very little sense. Because you know what I mean? Why would we not be somewhat bereft or grieving or mourning the fact that this will, that something does not last, especially just after Rilke gave us this heightened experience.
No, you're right. It is mysterious. If you have a collection like particularly the sonnet and also the sonnets to Orpheus, then you have a sort of, you know, each sonnet does roughly what you've described. But then, of course, another sonnet comes along and sort of does it again in a slightly in a different way. And so I suppose the moment of sort of feeling bereft or nostalgic is sort of replaced by another deeper realization of sort of what life feels like when you're really, when you've really got a keen sense for it, when you're not being distracted or thinking of other things. So it's sort of repeatable, I suppose, that's the thing. And that is quite important. And I suppose that's why people go back to Rilke. It's quite extraordinary that we didn't mention any statistics or anything, and I don't have any proper statistics, but someone said the other day, and I'm sure they're right, that, I mean, Rilke's read in English, he's read more in America than any other English poet. And there are something like 15 translations of the elegies available now. I mean, it's crazy, really.
I wonder whether something we just said is what you said, one of the reasons why people go back to it, because you're given a somewhat heightened sense of experience. I think sometimes there is a reminder, which I appreciate, that Rilke reminds us that even the most fleeting, banal, and insignificant circumstance can have a kind of depth for us if we pay attention. There's always a kind of attentiveness. Yeah. His apprenticeship with Rodin, which always makes me laugh because Rodin said, get out of my way, go to the Jardin des Plantes, look at some animals. And, yes. And I'm probably making this up entirely from my memories of the letters. But then Rilke comes back and Rodin said, what do you do? Look 3 hours, go back, look for 8 hours. You have to look at everything. Yeah. And so Rilke does this kind of long immersion in the world. Yeah. That is nice for us because we are, of course, you know, not always capable of that. And then when we lose that, then I think why Rilke go back, because he doesn't end up saying either, oh, we should celebrate this. Now we are better people, deeper human beings, have gained some moral edge on anybody. Mm. Nor does he say, you have to grieve this loss. And that's what is a kind of, you can return over and over. And your book is so nice, I think, because you seem to arrive at every poem anew. You don't feel, oh, I figured this out. He did this in the new poems. He did this in Malta. Yeah. He did this in the sound. No. Let me go to the next one. There's no progression. There's no progression in a strange way also means maybe there isn't loss at the end of something. So the reading becomes more of a circular experience of going back and remembering, oh, he took me into this experience. Now it's gone, but the poem allows you to go back to it.
That is very much, and I'm glad you say it is like that, because that's what I did want to try and do in the book, not sort these poems out and kind of put them in separate, you know, in their right boxes, but just to try and let them breathe, I suppose, and see what's there. And obviously there'd be different things there for different people. But I think I just did feel quite strongly, and I still do actually, that quite a lot of the readings of Rilke, again, you know, with exceptions, they just don't give a very good account of all that's going on when you read a Rilke poem, or when you read a poem even.
Right.
And particularly that sort of physical involvement and that way that you're compelled to, as I said before, almost become the poem in your way of sort of tracing through what's actually happening on the page. And I suppose, you know, that's a particular kind of experience. It's a kind of aesthetic experience, which I think Rilke thought was extremely important. And that takes us back to the poems about reading that I didn't say before, is that they're, what I think they suggest is that for him, reading is a particular domain of experience which has sort of possibilities in it which other kinds of experience don't really have.
And what you say in the explain in the book on what Rilke does, often as a kind of sleight of hand, what you call an aesthetic experience, Rilke then swaps out a term and it's suddenly, or for him at the same moment, existential, an experience, yes. A decision about life. So what you're describing when he talks about the reading experience, being immersed in a poem, being left by the poem in a state kind of suspension or sort of thinking, you're kind of gasping at the end of the poem because there's often a turn or the poem concludes in an unexpected way and you feeling, wait, I was taken somewhere, but where am I now? So yes. Rilke describes this in his letters and prose lots of times, and then he switches categories completely. It's not about a poem, about poetry, about art. It's about life.
Yeah.
And this is really interesting to me because your book is called The Life of the Work.
Yeah.
That this term life for Rilke is sometimes used, I think, in a way to describe what you're saying, an aesthetic experience of reading. Mm-hmm. And that's why it has this incredible urgency.
Yeah.
So he's not a removed poet where it's a bit
harder. No, not at all. Right? No. I mean, you know, of course, you know, reading a book is, or whatever, reading a poem is not something which happens outside life. It happens right in the middle of life and sort of, in some ways, that intensifies what one might get out of life otherwise. I mean, you know, if you read Rilke's letters, then he's never really talking. He doesn't talk about art very much, actually, or poetry, hardly ever about poetry. And he's not, that's not, he talks all the time about life, though. And a lot of his letters are, you know, especially the ones to Luandra Salomé and to his wife, but all of them really, they're completely concerned about how to get one's life right. What one has to do to actually sort of get through something which is not somehow, I suppose, authentic or quite complete, but to sort of live a better life. And for him, it's pretty clear that most of the time is the same thing as writing. But what it means in more general terms is that there isn't really a distinction to be made between a kind of aesthetic experience and a, whatever the opposite is going to be, a kind of real experience. They're both versions of one another.
And I like this when he says how to live your life correctly or in the right way. And there's some, I think, letters to a young poet and other things. Rilke has very funny descriptions when he talks about himself. He's always the eternal student, always failing. There's never any accomplishment. And the letters are very charming because ever so often Rilke will say, of course, I can only say all of this because I have no idea myself. I can't handle anything at all. And there's also the staged helplessness with all of his donors. He says, oh, I don't know how to do this. Could you just send me food for the next week and furnish this apartment and also send me traveler? The kind of incompetence in daily things, which is completely staged, I think, in certain ways.
Yes, yeah.
But there's something about learning life. For him, it's a project. You can actually, and that's why Letters to a Young Poet have this program, this didactic dimension. You can actually learn to live your life better.
Yes, but to learn to live one life doesn't mean to find the right technique and just apply it. It means sort of the opposite, really. It means always starting from the beginning and never quite knowing for sure. I mean, he hates certainty, I think, really.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, that can have a negative side, but it can also have a very positive side that you know, life is sort of, open. What it means, how you do it, is something that is never really allowed to kind of settle into kind of a fixed form. And similarly, the poems, they manage to be, you can read a poem and then you can read it again. I mean, any good poem, really, it's never going to do the same thing on each reading.
It's interesting when you think, you mentioned this very briefly, and I'm not even sure you're going to it at all, but there's a German reception of Rilke, which I'm not as deeply familiar with as I should be, but there was a long period of dismissing Rilke as an aesthete, as also a feat. It starts with Bertolt Brecht and Thomas Mann, who are just filled with this beautiful jealousy and rage and say, why is this poet writing to these teenage girls and fancy ladies and more successful than we are? And then Brecht grudgingly acknowledges, okay, he's a genius, and Thomas Mann grudgingly acknowledges. But it goes then through the German reception is that, and this is an important point, I think, that this is all a deception. This is all artifice. Yes. This is the play of language. And the critic Paul de Man, who did the introduction for the Gallimard edition of the French translation, which is a beautiful essay, he says at the end of this essay, it's a promise based on a lie. And Rilke knows what we just described, that you could actually be more deeply in life. It's just deception. It's the play of language on the surface, etc. And de Man then says, and see, proof is that Rilke ultimately gave up on German and starts writing in French and give because he couldn't deliver this sense of living more deeply or more, the word he wouldn't have used that I would use as more authentically, which is a corrupted word now. But it's interesting, there's a whole set of people who also distrust this project, I think, and who feel it's almost too successful, too beautiful.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, and I think it was especially in the 70s in Germany that there was a lot of distrust of him. I suppose he was perceived as not being political enough in a kind of obvious kind of way as well. But I think it is more fundamentally a distrust of the virtuosity and of the power that the poems seem to exert. And I'm sure that most of the people who reject him, they reject him not because they just don't have any response, but because they have too strong a response of some kind.
Right. Right.
I think that's pretty clear from what people have said. I don't know, but there is something very interesting about Hulke. I mean, sometimes he's accused of kind of touching on kind of kitsch, and there is definitely a side to his writing which you might call kind of precious, or it's kind of flirting with the precious all the time. But then a positive way of thinking about that is that he's experimenting. He's on the edge of something, so he's outside what we're familiar and comfortable with. The kind of way that he's way of being outside that is to be towards an interest in sensation, somehow sensation and intensity being good in themselves, irrespective of what sort of content they might have. And so there's good reasons to be suspicious about that kind of thing. And you know, not all poems work either. There are some poems which clearly are kitschy or precious.
You have a very elegant way of, in the book, sort of pointing out and in some way saying, this is a bit kitschy, or he tried something here. This metaphor is really strained and overdone. But then you say, it appears to me he's trying to do this. Whether it worked or not is really not my concern. It doesn't look so effective right here. But you give us a sense of this is not, this is never experimentation for its own sake. There's always something at stake. Yeah. So I think that gives his work this urgency that people feel, even when he pushes a metaphor too far, or you think, this is, in German sometimes you hear it, Lou Andreas Salome said to him when he was very young, you rhyme way too much. You have to tone it down.
Yes.
You're just going on, and he could just do that. Mm. It's sort of like a dressmaker puts too many frills and, you know, ruffles onto a dress. He's something to simplify the whole thing. Mm. But in these moments, he's still trying to do something, and it's not ever, in my sense, he's after something, but he's just in something. He's in this poem. He wants to go deeper into the poem. He never wants to take you out of it.
No. Yeah, I think that's right. And he's not thinking about things like taste when he's in that, you know, doing that. He's exploring what possibilities the language sort of holds, and where it can take him at a particular time. And that's, you know, as readers, that's also, and I think it's probably also true, I can't think of an example exactly, but I think it must be true that even the more doubtful parts, you could respond to them differently in different times. So, you know, you might feel, on one day, you might feel, well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to suspend my disbelief to this extent. Other days, you might be more disposed towards them and more open to what's going on. It comes down to the fact he's taking risks with language and what you can do, what you can sort of get away with, though he doesn't think it was getting away, but that's sort of how it looks from outside. And so there's bound to be failures or moments that are doubtful. But it's all to do with, you know, in the end, what he's doing, I suppose, is trying to get more of human experience into language. And that's not something you can do with a kind of, you know, you just know how to do it and just surely do it. It may feel like that sometimes in particular poems, but actually it's always going to be exploratory, and so always have the possibility of not quite working.
I was thinking when you were saying that right now, I was thinking whether there is an equivalent, or actually whether there's a poet who has a certainty in his own work. In the German tradition, there are moments in Goethe where he probably has some certainty. Then there are moments, but I was thinking of Shakespeare's sonnets that are just an object of fascination, I think, because they seem to start again in new places with a kind of excitement. We're going to start here. I'm going to start here. I'm going to start here. Yes. Where some of the great plays, there's a certainty and a surety that he knows what language can do.
Yeah.
The sonnets, language is kind of let loose. Language can do certain things. It has effects. It has an effect or something, and then you move on, rather than it's in the service of this grand idea, this greater idea. And that's why Wilke is probably ultimately known more, although you talk about the novel Malta. He's more of a poet because poetry allows these kinds of starting over and over again.
And that's completely, you know, part of his understanding of poetry, especially on the sonnets to Orpheus. The whole thing about poetry is it sort of ends so that it can start again, and you're always sort of beginning again. Right. And, you know, you've got these 55 sonnets and they're all just metrically different. And he wasn't, as far as you can tell, he wasn't deliberately saying, right, I mustn't repeat this form here, this pattern here. He can't have been, because he wrote it all so quickly. But it seems that he's constitutionally unable to do the same thing twice. And that must go with this sort of belief in the importance of beginning.
And you pay a lot of attention to beginnings in the early part of your book. You look at the beginnings of the poem cycles, the several cycles of poems. Can I ask you, I have two specific questions, and our listeners have to bear with me, because that's what I'm really interested in Rilke. So this idea of hard work or Herzwerk, which you talk about a bit in kind of the middle, there's a period in Rilke's life and work where people have constructed this a bit of a, there's an intensification or a change from the early collections of poems. Let's say 1914, 15. He's now being kicked out of Paris, where he had settled and found something closer to a home. He's in Munich waiting for the draft notice. And he writes this poem to Lou Andrea Salome. It's translated either as turning point. I think it's Wendung. I would assume it could also be just transition or turning, not a point. And there he has this very well-known for Rilke critics line, like, I've looked at the world long enough, now I have to do hard work, like H-A-R-T, work, Herzwerk. And could you say something about this? Because I'm really interested in what this is supposed to do, what this transition is, giving up something and doing something else here. It's not quite a transition, as you point out.
I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical of the sort of prominence this poem is being given as denoting a shift in his work. I mean, clearly the idea that he's going away from Werk des Gesichts, so kind of work of kind of looking, which he's, you know, everyone thinks he does that, especially in the Neue Gedichte, including Rilke himself. And then Herzwerk would be somehow processing these images rather than within in some way. I suppose it anticipates this interest in the invisible, which we get later on in the elegies. If you look at the Neue Gedichte, then it's the new poems, it's pretty clear that he's doing, you know, both heart work and work of looking at the same time there. And I think in a way he's telling himself in this poem, Wendung, that he needs to move on, which is really what he's doing. Tun und Herzwerk, so do heart work now, is sort of an artificial way of constructing a new phase for himself, sort of helping himself move onwards. But actually, he doesn't then do something radically different. He does then explore more a kind of poetic tradition as opposed to a tradition in the visual arts, I think. He starts reading a lot more German. That's also interesting. So it's then that he reads Hölderlin properly and Goethe and other writers, expressionists and so on. Whereas before he was very much writing as a poet, really in the French tradition, above all Baudelaire and then French visual artists. There is a shift of a sort, which I think in his work translates into a greater focus on the means of poetry itself and language and what can be done in words specifically as against what other art forms can do. In the end, any poetry, any kind of mental activity involves Herzwerk, and always did for Rilke too, I think.
There's such prominence given to this term, and you say rightly, it doesn't mean there's really a break, a shift, we go to this new phase here, but there's more of a maybe continuity that he wanted to imply. And this poem is also, as you say, a little bit, you say, over-deliberate, it's maybe a little bit programmatic, but I'm not sure if all mental activity is Herzwerk in Rilke's sense.
No.
He does think somehow we can go through the world, we can be super attentive, we can also be very skillful poets even, have all these technical facility and yet end up writing something that hasn't genuinely the English word is processed. It's a horrible word for what Rilke is trying to say, like it's a computer or something like that. That's not what it is. It's not, we're not processing information. We're actually making it our own, understanding it will not stay our own, and maintaining both the awareness that we had this experience, but it isn't ours because it's already passed. This weird sense of temporality. I would just love to hear a little bit more what you say there. And I understand your skepticism, because it's not the term that really defines Rilke's program, but it touches on something also, because it goes to this bodily metaphor, which I think it's not...
Well, that's what I was sort of going to say. I mean, the thing about Herz and the way Rilke uses the word heart very often seems to be as a sort of way, obviously, you know, he knew very well that the heart isn't literally involved. And what he means by heart partly is I think, when all the senses, including the sort of spiritual senses, are involved at the same time. So it goes towards this sense of kind of concentration and intensity and involvement of the whole mind and body at once, I think. I think in the end, that's what Herzwerk comes to. And so I suppose what that means, then, if we're thinking about the move from Gesicht to, well, work of looking to the work of the heart, then we're going from something which is really depends just on one sense or a very small subsection of what's available to something much more compact, which involves the whole person in the widest sense. And of course, what that means then is kind of, you know, making use of all that humans have at their have available for them to them. And so again, one can think about it in relation to the elegies, I suppose, because in the elegies start off by really lamenting the human failings, which then later on come to be seen, or is able, possible to see them as strengths, and precisely because they of this in-betweenness that you're physically in the world, but at the same time you're detached from the world because of your consciousness. And that, if you start thinking about it, nearly always seems to be a problem. But if you somehow manage to kind of just live it, then you realise that that's what makes the human situation sort of unique. And so I suppose Herzwerk, yeah, I mean, you could say that the angels can't do Herzwerk and the animals can't do Herzwerk, but human beings can. He also uses, I mean, Herz involves also the sort of the kind of sensual side. I mean, the sexuality as well is clearly part of it. I mean, I think that's a very interesting part of Rilke that isn't spoken about so much, and I do try and talk about a bit in my book, the way in which a kind of erotic or sexual response to the world is something we shouldn't sort of deny or sort of overlook. It's very much part of how we do respond to the world, and we're not giving a full account of that if we neglect it. And that's not quite what he's naming consciously with Herzwerk at that point, but it's what it develops into, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really nice that you just pointed that out. I was going to ask you about that. So you said there's the kind of visual experience of the world as a great artist, and let's say in 19-teens or something like that, his models are also Rodin, which is not just visual, but also three-dimensional sculptural in the world. Rodin, this over-sexualized being, this kind of gruff, huge man, which is really interesting. And Rilke spends so much time with him. And because he's so different from Rilke at that time. You think Rilke is this kind of hesitating, skittish poet, and Rodin is this overwhelming masculinity. And then he said there's a spiritual dimension. And I think if we sort of open this up, there's a kind of intellectual dimension, the aesthetic experience of the world as seeing it. Then he says Herzwerk now starts to involve a spiritual dimension, which I think critics have been really good to not talk about by calling it existentialist. And then I think there's a very brilliant set of readings that go on through the century of the kind of Rilke as an existentialist, proto-existentialist, which people don't want to call spiritual because that's not a word we use in academia, kind of. And then the bodily, sexual, he says he writes these phallic poems right afterwards. They're very famous. And also in a weird way, still, as you said, there's a kind of unease because we want our Rilke to sort of make us live in a world that's a bit purified. And here, I think Rilke says there's nothing any longer abstracted, purified, refined about the world. Once you do this Herzwerk, you're fully in the world, including your desires, your drives.
Yes, exactly.
So it's not you arrive in some realm of the elegies where you can outdo our mortal existence. You actually just know how hard it is to be a physical human being that has a mind that wants to separate from the body and have sexual and other desires that we can't even transcend or sublimate. So all of these dimensions are kind of coming into it here, what he calls Herzwerk, not just you go from seeing things to...
Exactly. I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's sort of, he comes in some ways from Nietzsche, I suppose, this sense that you have to face up to all aspects of the world, which also means all aspects of yourself. They're all involved. So if you pretend they're not, then you're just deceiving yourself. You're just missing out on what's actually going on. So to try and give a fuller account of the kind of breadth of experience, I think is, in a way, that's what Rilke's doing, really. And Herzwerk is a shift towards it.
If I can ask you another question, so let's say if we think of Herzwerk or hard work as kind of a deeper, more of an opening to how we are in the world already, nothing is added to it. We're just becoming a bit more awakened to how we are already. So Rilke never says, you're going to reach this transcendent state. He says, you're just going to be reminded of where you already are.
Yeah.
And then the poem that you talk about the requiems in a very beautiful way and the elegies. And then there's a poem called Death. He has several poems on death. Yeah. And I was quite interested in whether this can do the work of letting us account for the knowledge and the experience of death or of losing somebody or something and not be just torn back out of life into grief and numbness and removal, but in Rilke's way to say, oh, this will put you more deeply into life. And I think this is the, to me, this becomes one of the big questions for the elegies and for all these works afterwards, that Herzberg is supposed to do this incredible thing that we're supposed to get a bit more comfortable with the fact that we will not last.
Der Tod. Da steht der Tod, ein bläulicher Absud in einer Tasse ohne Untersatz. There stands death, some bluish dregs, in a cup without a saucer. Such a strange place for a cup, standing on the back of a hand. Quite clearly, you can make out on the glazed curve the spot where the handle broke off, dusty, and hope across its bow in a used-up Gothic script. The man who was to drink out of that cup read this aloud at breakfast long ago. What kind of beings are they then who finally must be scared away by poison? Otherwise, would they stay here? Are they really obsessed with this food full of obstacles? The hard present moment must be pulled out of them like a set of false teeth. Then they babble, babble, babble. O falling star, once seen into from a bridge, not to forget you, stand and endure.
I mean, I certainly think, you know, bereavement anyway is an experience which does sort of place you back in life more kind of firmly in many ways. Of course, you know, you've lost something which is gone. But it's gone in what sense? I mean, it's gone in some sense, but it's sort of the person by disappearing has in some sense become closer oddly because you realise everything. But of course, you know, that's a big theme, though, that, you know, you only really, really realise what things are worth once they've gone. I think he took that really quite seriously as being a sort of almost like a sort of a faculty that, you know, that's how we perceive things as when they're gone, really. And that might be another example. That certainly is another sort of implication of what Herzberg is, I think. So das Gesicht ist getan, because you can only see things which are actually there, but Herzberg you can somehow connect with when they're no longer there, and in some ways that's better. So, I mean, I don't know. He doesn't talk, as far as I remember, he doesn't talk very much about specific instances of bereavement of his own. He's normally talking about other people's bereavement, oddly. And he doesn't talk very much at all about, you know, when his father dies or when his mother dies or anything like that. We hear nothing, really. He obviously did have a number of bereavements. I mean, and he thought a lot about kind of what they meant. And I don't think he's, you know, his notion that life and death really are a unity and that dying has to be a form of kind of bringing your life to perfection in some way or kind of bringing it to its highest point. That can sound very abstract and sort of all very well, rather kind of theoretical, but not actually very helpful. But I don't think that's at all what he meant, really. I think he was actually trying to be quite honest about the fact that the experience of bereavement does oddly kind of anchor you more deeply in the world. So I'm not really answering your question, probably.
No, I'm really, let me just stay there because I'm really, it's a genuine question. It's not a sort of, there's an answer in Rilke, but what you said that he wants to have us experience bereavement, not as removal out of life, as a kind of numb, what I experienced, sort of, we've all had our experiences of loss, of not being fully in life, not being full alive, or being too sensitized, that we think, I don't want anything exciting to happen, good or bad, because I'm so fragile or exposed that I can't handle that. And Rilke's sort of what you're saying, he said, if we allow ourselves to acknowledge that that is part of life and not the opposite of life.
Yes.
And yet then he stops short of saying, oh, and that'll console you for your loss. He says the word consolation is not in his vocabulary. He said, this is not a word. He said, there's nothing. Time will just put things in their place.
Yes.
But I'm interested what you think when the poems, why they work for people at some moments, not always.
No.
But there is a moment when I think when you look up, as we said in the beginning of this conversation, from a poem and you think, how maybe I'm not alone in this. And I think that's an important part. Not that I've been consoled over this, but I understand this is part of life in general.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, there are a number of experiences, I suppose extreme experiences of different kinds, that to take us out of life. And basically, Rilke is suggesting that in fact they do the opposite. And of course, it's partly a question of understanding, really, just how we talk about these things. If we think of sort of our normal everyday lives as being the sum of what life is, then of course you do feel estranged from that. But then if you think that the everyday life, not to discount the nature of everyday life at all, but it involves quite a lot of avoiding, because you have to avoid larger questions and sort of larger connections in order to kind of get through a normal day. If you think of, those things are things which you kind of need, but there are times when you're able to put them to one side for a moment, probably only, then these extreme experiences like death and falling in love and other things he mentions, as you say, do kind of bring you deeper in. I mean, his general attitude his general kind of position on death in sort of early 20th century Europe is that it's being pushed out to the margins. People are made to die as if in factories, as he puts it in Malta. And we're coping with modernity by basically repressing death and getting it out of our immediate area of experience, which of course is very much what's happened. You know, we don't tend to know if the next door neighbour's died, really, or whatever it might be. It's all kind of very clinical and hushed up in most cultures. And he's saying that if you do that, then you kind of make a kind of monster out of death, really. You make some terrible thing out there, which is always sort of somehow threatening from outside, where of course it's not really out there at all. It's actually part of us. It's a physical part of our makeup. And the poem you mentioned, one of the ones called Death or Der Tod, he talks about the way we've effectively taken the teeth out of death and made it into this kind of babbling kind of monster which can't articulate anything clear to us. Or we've turned it into a residue as opposed to a sort of cup of something nourishing. This is exactly an example of the kind of thing we were talking earlier, where we were talking about kind of kitsch and preciousness, because these kind of thoughts, they can seem too easily stated and thus not very useful.
If I can ask this poem, which I sort of return to because of your book, and it's just such a fabulous poem, and I use this word deliberately because it's so over the top in the beginning of this, of the death as the kind of residue in the cup that says hope on it, some cheesy cup you picked up somewhere and it's balancing on the back of a hand. And so the image just keeps on getting more and more. Then it says it's at the end, it's just babbling. Yes. And then there's this dotted line in the poem, and I'll put this in the notes of this podcast. And then there are three more lines. And in some ways, also for our listeners who should not walk away thinking, oh, Rilke is a poet about death. It's a poet about love, ultimately. When you said a moment ago, there are experiences in life that seem to take us out of life, but should actually put us more deeply into it. Mm. Death may be one. Love is the other one for Rilke. Over and over, the image. So those last three lines, which I just find, and I was giving a talk on Rilke recently, and I looked at these lines, and I thought, partly prompted by your book, because it's such a beautiful reading, and I thought, so then he stands on this bridge, it's clearly night, because there's a shooting star or a falling star, and then he says, in the beginning, the cup stands on the back of the hand, and now he says, you're supposed to stand up, or stehen, which is very Rilke, sort of the end of the archaic torso of Apollo, you must change your life, is imperative. But stand up, or standing up, which is very odd in a poem about death.
Yeah.
When it's all about falling. And what you said, he wants to actually have us a moment where we would not see these relations as gain and loss, up and down, rising and falling for a brief moment. And I was really curious how you make sense of these three lines, because it's, to me, such a incredibly romantic, beautiful moment. And I was talking to students and I said, who wouldn't want to stand on a bridge and see a shooting star reflected reflected in the water? And I tried to explain to them, we're implying that it's nighttime. He doesn't say nighttime, he just thinks stars, you see them at night. We're implying it goes over water, because it's a bridge, mostly over water, probably over a river in Rwanda or in Paris or in Venice, wherever he was. And so I'm kind of curious how you make sense of these three lines, because they're sort of, they're not redemption, but there's kind of, here's death, this horrible, graphic, cruel thing, and then this other thing is there.
Well, it does seem, in the dynamics of the poem, it does seem as if those final lines must if the poem is to work, they must in some sense kind of counterbalance what's gone before, not just the content of the kind of babbling death, but also the kind of extreme sort of surreal kind of grotesqueness of some of the images where, it's incredible stuff, but it's also, we can't live with that. It's sort of various and choppy and unattractive, I suppose, even. And then you have somehow these last three lines have to be able to kind of stand up against all that and somehow balance it out in some way. But I think there's also a sort of a kind of hidden argument going on in that the falling star, you know, a shooting star is a star which is, well, it's not even a proper star, but, it, you know, it's something which is burning itself out. And so it's something which is dying. And of course, it's as it dies that it becomes what it is, i.e. a shooting star. It's only a shooting star for the moment of our seeing it and for the moment of it disappearing. And so death and life are held in one in that image, aren't they? They're the same thing. And I think that's sort of that's why he says never forget. It's the kind of reminder that they can't actually be separated in the end. So the poem is kind of correcting itself, really, for its weakness in dwelling too much on death as something grotesque. Although it's criticising it at the same time, it's also, of course, doing it itself. And then there's this ... this kind of open line. We don't know what that is, but it's a break of some kind. And then just the hope that an image can somehow counterbalance all that. And it is, above all, as you say, an image of standing on the bridge and seeing the thing. And of course, yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, there are a number of experiences, I suppose extreme experiences of different kinds, that to take us out of life. And basically, Rico is suggesting that in fact they do the opposite.
And I thought two additional things. I would be curious what you think about that. When the first part, which you said, has to be balanced out in a way, otherwise we're left with this horrifying fragmented images of death. This line ... I thought that's the water, the horizon line, where the poem is reflecting itself. And you can say that's a kind of a gimmick, and it's just kind of. And I've seen translations that omit that line, and I think, well, you missed the point of the poem. This is a bridge. And there's above and below, and all of the poem is, the poem is actually just doing what it's saying.
Yeah.
And some critics would say, well, here you go, Rilke again, kind of tricking us into sensing this doubleness and sensing the symmetry and feeling it more, because a lot of things we just said, we have to infer, which Rilke kind of telegraphs to us, like shooting star on a bridge, seen once, you, and then there's this kind of address, dich nicht vergessen. And I think, and I wonder how you make sense of this last line, dich nicht vergessen. Who is he addressing at that moment?
I did. When I actually saw that in my book, I was worried it might be a misprint, but it's not, is it then? It is dich nicht vergessen.
I think so.
That's correct. Yeah, okay. I think that's probably. I suppose the most obvious one is the Sternenfall, isn't it? It's U Sternenfall. Yeah. So the U implies the address.
And
yes, I think it's the Sternenfall. It's that moment. And of course, remembering that particular moment, which is implicitly a moment in his own life, does mean that, you know, that we have to hold on to our experience,
right,
and allow our individual experience to be as powerful as this kind of realization of what is happening to death in the modern age, and how Christianity has failed to sort of deal with it properly, which is implicitly what the poem is saying. And I think also very interesting, the last word, Stehen, that brings us back to what you were saying before about the sort of simultaneity of the aesthetic and the existential or the ethic, because of course Stehen is above all a kind of existential sort of imperative, you know, stand up to it, don't succumb. But at the same time, it's also something he's imploring the poem to do, urging the poem itself to do.
Right.
It has to have that sort of power of offsetting negative. And so it's both those things at once.
Oh, but that's nice, right? Because in German, it would be the poem sort of stands on the page or something. The word
standing.
It's like typesetting for us or something like that. It's a regular word you would use.
Yeah, steht geschrieben. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's like a word's written on a page. That would be it stands written. So it's like the poem. And I wonder, I'll ask you one about this, not to forget you. I also wonder whether this is another one of Rilke's effective tricks. He's also at this moment turned out of the poem toward you, toward the reader, which the reader, you hear that, so you think, oh, he's addressing the shooting star, looking back, reflecting on the past, but he's also at that moment turned out of the poem. And then I said to my students, because I do what you do essentially in your book, you sort of, you have to re-experience a poem each time. And this last time I taught it, I thought, who wouldn't want to stand on a bridge and see a shooting star reflected in the water, which is a one-time occurrence of a moment that you just described as the death of the star, which is its only life for us and gives us light at that moment, and to share that with someone would be so magical because it only happens then and there. You're in this here and now of that moment, and you could say to somebody, and we all had this experience, to look at shooting stars and say, oh, did you see this one? Did you see this one?
Yes, and they never have.
And exactly. Yes. But there's, for Rilke, I think, a profound happiness. And if someone says, oh, yes, I saw that one.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. I mean, the Rilke's use of du and dich, and so the you words, they're really fascinating, I think. But there's always one possibility, always is, quite a strong possibility, is he's addressing the reader in some way.
Right.
And it's one of the ways in which the poems do, that's another reason for their popularity. We do feel kind of addressed and drawn in. And of course, some people like that, and some people don't like that. They feel it's too sort of too forward, too close, and they which goes back to what we were saying before about the sort of distrust. I mean, I think here is actually probably a little bit harder to read it in that way than in other places.
Yeah,
but it's still clearly a possibility.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's harder to do it. It's where Rilke, I think, is so exciting to read because it works on. This is a totally wrong word, in a subliminal level. You just see the word dich and you feel, oh, okay. But you don't. You know it's not you being addressed. So there are lots of things happening on the level of sound, or they just capture something that's not explicit. And you can't really build an entire argument here. So, you could write an academic paper, the second person's address in Rilke, and someone said, this is not the right one. But the word is there. So the word
And also it's underwritten by lots of other instances in Rilke where it clearly is the case. I mean, obviously the end of the Architectors of Apollos, You Must Change Your Life, that clearly does address the reader as well as the poet addressing himself. And so, I do think that's actually a way of summing up in a rather kind of oversimple way what I'm trying to do in the book is to take that idea seriously, as if all the poems in a way were saying, you must dein Leben ändern, but of course much less explicitly and not necessarily even believing that that can happen, but still there's that kind of injunction that inhabits them. And Stehen is exactly the same, really.
And as you said earlier, it's a kind of summons to change your life without a program, which means everybody
is... Yeah, that's
is,
very important, yeah.
Like you kind of cast back on yourself, say, like, you, Charlie, you have to change your life in a very different way from how I have to change my life. So there's and I think Rilke is occasionally succumbs to these programs. So he has these embarrassing, awkward political moments when he embraces, which other people, Martin Buber, Thomas Mann, celebrate the war in 1914, Karl Kraus doesn't. Thank God we have a few people who don't, actually. But I think he says, he addresses the reader and then kind of says, okay, and now I'm discharging you into your own responsibility of having had this experience with me of this poem. But you're on your own. And that's,
Definitely. Yeah. No, I think that's very true. I mean, there's sort of no specific content, but there's a kind of movement, a kind of impulse which comes from the poem. Because I think, You Must Change Your Life at the end of the Archaic Torso of Apollo poem. Of course, You Must Change Your Life on its own is a completely empty statement to say. I mean, it's the worst thing you should say to anybody who wants to, if you want them to change their lives, really. But somehow the way it's placed within the poem and the way it kind of grows out of the experience of the statue on the one hand and the poem on the other makes it more sort of credible. It gives it more force.
Right.
And I think a lot of Rilke poems have a similar sort of... pattern to them. I suppose it's basically because of the kind of intensity with which they have responded to the world, and they sort of give you a desire to emulate that kind of intensity. And that sort of tension, as you said earlier, kind of attentiveness.
Yeah, and in the what you just said made me think in the Archaic Apollo, the Torso of Apollo, that poem centers on this empty, there's an empty center somehow, which we all know, the sculpture has no head, there's a kind of empty centering, and then all this stuff happens. You must change your life as if you have to place yourself. You can place yourself into this empty center of signification.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And it's also a confrontation with some sort of trace from a former life, an ancient form, which somehow carries a kind of conviction with it, which implicitly your life doesn't seem to have at that moment reading the poem.
Right.
And it's out of the contrast that you then gain the desire to live your life.
I mean, we've touched on one poem exactly so far, so we could do a couple more hours of this.
Yes.
The one thing I would love to ask you, you know, I hope you're translating the sonnets to Orpheus and the elegies into English. I think if you have some spare time or something, that would be a great project, because I love all the translations in the book. And
Well, that's good. Yeah. I mean, I'm not. I mean, apart from the insofar as they're in the book. I mean, there are really good translations available of certainly the sonnets to Orpheus. I mean, so Don Paston's versions of those, I think, are very good indeed. The elegies, I'm not so sure if there's a really good version of the elegies, but I don't know if I can do it, though.
It's interesting. I think there's, on some level, sometimes it's just a matter of tone and translation and the gift of the translator. And some moments in the elegies, though, because when you start teaching them, you have to do it very slowly, and you realize there's some slight errors in the translation that have now been passed through dozens of translations.
Yeah, that's very possible. Yeah, I haven't looked at them, you know, really carefully, I must say.
Yeah, but you're lucky. I mean, we're lucky we can look at it in two languages, so it's different in a way, I think, if someone is really coming from the English perspective.
No, sure, yeah.
So I want to thank you for this conversation, and I really want to just say thank you for giving us this book, which also for our listeners has a great index. So people who just read Rilke on a, you know, whatever personal basis, you can just look up a poem and see how Charlie made sense of it, which I think is part of the joy of this book, to see you made sense of it in a particular way. Mm. That is maybe also what Rilke wanted, that deepens our experience of the one poem, because we have another experience.
Well, thanks very much to you, Uli. That's been a great conversation. It's been very kind of you to you know, ask me to come along. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you.
Wonderful. Yeah. And it's nice to meet you. And
I hope
we'll have an occasion at some point to speak in person. And then I just to our listeners. So this is part of a long series. I think that we have 50 episodes now on great books, everything from Ralph Ellison to Zora Neale Hurston to Paul Celan to Rilke. So people can tune in. They can find it on my website. All the episodes are there. They're on Spotify, Apple, etc. And I'll put some notes into the website for this episode, so people can look up your work. So again, I'll remind them, this was a conversation with Professor Charlie Lauth, who's at Oxford University. So thank you so much. And he's the author of Rilke, The Life of the Work, which is a book that all the readers should try to get their hands on.